Just to put on the record, I just had a brief conversation with Mr. West. He asked when the deadline was for written testimony. I reiterated it is the end of the hearing, and we don't know when that is. So,
on that topic, Mr. Wynn and I had a conversation during the break trying to plan sort of the next few days to...
I was going to ask about that at the end of the hearing, but go ahead.
So we have Ms. Barnes, who we'll bring back up to finish. And then we have only a handful of witnesses left at that point, one of whom is Teresa Doherty, who will, the chief part of her testimony will be about differences with the city, and we're still working on some of those. So
okay.
We had anticipated she wouldn't be talking for a few days. So what I'd like to propose is we finish with Ms. Barnes, and then we all gather again on Monday, and we've got Professor Way in the morning, and then our transportation experts who will go after that, and then we'll probably be in a position to have Ms. Doherty testify at that point. I actually think we might be able to get through close to everybody on Monday. We might get a little bit into Tuesday morning, and then the city, Roger, you can go ahead and speak for the...
You need to move your mic a little bit closer.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. I heard you, but I think it recorded, but just so that everybody hears you.
Thank you. So given the constraints we have with three of our witnesses, we'd like to request that you could reserve Tuesday at 1 o'clock, assuming that there's not too much public testimony, but as promptly as we can, if we could break whatever other testimony is coming from the parties at that point and have those three witnesses, Mr. Glass Hastings, Ms. Scholl, and Mr. Durant, then.
Okay, so you anticipate finishing your direct on Monday?
I think we'll be either done Monday or in the first part of Tuesday.
Okay, and then Tuesday you're saying 1 o'clock for your three witnesses?
Correct, and I'm hoping that even if you're not completely done...
We're happy. Yeah, we have no objection to
All right.
Letting them speak.
Okay. And...
And so we'd rather not start a brand new witness after Ms. Barnes today and then cut her off at 5, even... Our preference would be to finish with Ms. Barnes and finish for the day and then take this back up on Monday. And we don't think we're going to lose any time overall. We're certainly...
Okay. As far as public testimony goes, either the university has done an amazing job or or it's Friday and it's a beautiful day.
I have to admit we thought there'd be more.
I've never seen a master plan, even the ones that are not really heavily contested like this, on as far as public testimony goes. So that's why we planned all the time that we did for it. But the schedule that you've worked out is fine, and I'm glad to hear that you're still working on your differences. So we'll see where we are at the end. All right.
So let's
continue with Ms. Barnes' testimony.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
We are going to go through the design guidance for the East Campus.
Right.
That's where we left.
Yeah. Is this good for the microphone?
It is.
Okay. East Campus is kind of a new player in the future development vision of the university.
Let me interrupt you right away. What page are you going to hand to?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Why don't you turn to page 226?
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And also keep your finger in page 212 and 13. I say that because I think it may be helpful to some to flip back and forth between them, that 212 to 213 is more three-dimensional.
Okay.
This is the first time the university has really looked at a long-term future for East Campus as other than athletics and parking and the Union Bay Natural Area, and to begin to think of it as a place for future development of uses that fulfill the university's academic mission. The long-term vision is dense here. The 10-year conceptual plan is a very modest beginning to that of 750,000 square feet, only 12% of the whole growth allowance that we're looking for. So it's a small beginning. The university will feel its way towards what the best uses long term are for this area, but we'll have a, we have a plan in place, a vision plan in place through this campus master plan. There is no intention to disrupt or relocate athletic facilities. In fact, some of the development sites undoubtedly will be utilized for athletic-related facilities over time. And the Union Bay Natural Area will continue to be the preserve and wetlands-related area that it is now. And I think you can see that by where the buildings are located on the plan and in the diagram on pages 12 and 13. Some of the sort of thematic understanding of the East Campus development has to do with the challenging site conditions that exist in East Campus. It is, large parts of it are a landfill, and it is still producing methane, and it, as a result of that, it's a liquefaction zone, large parts of it. Not unlike parts of University Village right across the way from it. And there we know, of course, that development is possible. It costs a little more, and it has comes with extra moves that you have to make to achieve that. So that is taken into consideration here as well. Other challenging conditions of this site have to do with it being somewhat distant from the historic center of campus, but it's not really so much the horizontal distance as it is the fact that Mountain Lake runs between Central Campus and East Campus, and there's a steep slope along the west side of Mountain Lake at the eastern edge of East Campus. And for that reason, the long-term vision that I had you put your finger in, pages 212 and 213 for, is that long-term we imagine that there will need to be a land bridge or that type of connection between Central Campus and East Campus to facilitate the full build-out here. So that's in our vision, but it's not in the 10-year conceptual plan for the 750,000 square feet that we're asking for 2018 to 2028. There are many shoreline areas here, too, as you can see in both sets of diagrams. You know, the natural area is a wetlands, basically, and it provides all kinds of research and study experiences as well as recreational experiences for members of the university community and the larger community. In terms of heights, I think you can probably see better in the 212 and 213 diagram that we've located long-term the greater heights along Mount Lake, not imagining that the nature of Mount Lake is going to diminish as a major arterial for vehicle traffic in the area. And we've brought those heights down as you move in towards the wetlands part of the site. There are two residential housing areas that we also call East Campus, and in both of those cases, we're envisioning some increased density for housing at some point in time when the university would choose to redevelop. But they're modest, and they've incorporated ideas about open space and neighborhood scale with them as well.
Ms. Barnes, just to interject for one moment, are those two residential areas depicted as Development Zone P and Development Zone Q on pages 224 and 225?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. No, it's P and Q.
Isn't that what you said?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. It's, but what, I think what Ms. Barnes was
saying. Oh, it's not P.
Were the two kind of satellite areas not shown
it's
on.
It's Q. And then it's the northeast corner of O.
Right.
Yeah.
But I was, to clarify, I was trying to call your attention to the fact that those two areas that were kind of outside this map on page 26.
Correct. Understand. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. But I did want to mention that they're not, they exist, they're part of our, within our MIO. Yeah. Let me get back to 226 and point out view corridors and mid-block corridors that were, we've identified as protected as we think about the future development of this area. And a prioritized pedestrian connector, the yellow arrow that completes the network of pedestrian access and open space that's long-term part of the long-term vision for East Campus.
Great. Well, I think that's it for the different sectors design guidelines. Now let's talk about some of the specific development standards that apply to campus. You've mentioned many of these throughout your testimony so far, but I think it would be good to go through Chapter 7 and cover a few of them in more depth so we all understand them a little bit better.
Sure.
Let's start with kind of, can you provide an overview of the general structure of this chapter?
Well, it's important to realize that it's arranged alphabetically. I think that's the essential piece of information. It was the approach that we took to make it organized and accessible. And it includes an introduction, descriptions of development standards, and concludes with definitions.
Great. Let's talk about the standards for parking that are contained in this. Could you provide an overview of those?
Sure. University is gradually moving from a campus that parks cars almost entirely on surface lots to a mix of structured underground and surface facilities. Parking is managed campus-wide, not on a sector basis, on the university, at the university. This campus master plan allows for above-grade parking, but discourages it through design guidelines. And encourages underground parking where it's feasible. Site constraints may make it infeasible in locations such as where there is a very high water table, utility tunnels and corridors, or other subgrade obstructions.
Now let's talk about mid-block corridors. You've referenced those a few times throughout. Could you describe what those are and describe how they're different from the priority pedestrian corridors that are also identified?
Sure. The mid-block corridors that we've identified are intended to be major routes into and through parts of the campus, like major arterials. Whereas the priority pedestrian corridors are envisioned more as neighborhood streets. It's at a different scale, but they work together in a network. The mid-block corridors have a 25-foot minimum width and a view that's protected through. I think you could see the the corridors going down on the east and south campuses. They have to be at a height of, I think, two stories, or open to this. Yeah. They may be open to the sky.
Pages 239 and 240 discuss mid-block corridors.
I Right. They have to allow for minimum vertical clearance of either two floors of height or the height required to preserve a view corridor. They will make an enormous difference, the block corridors that we've identified on South Campus, and change that entire campus from a place that is, well, I've heard the informal testimony of many, many, many people over time saying they don't know how to make their way into, through, or out, or get out of South Campus. And this is going to clarify routes in and through, and create a sense of the waterfront as you're walking down Pacific as well, and from Central Campus to a certain extent, because we have pedestrian bridges crossing Pacific Street. So big, big change. And big changes to South Campus will be required to develop those pedestrian corridors. It's similar for East Campus, but also extremely dramatically different, since East Campus will be creating the entire fabric, and on South Campus it will be taking a piece of an existing fabric out strategically to allow for the creation of open space in the form of the mid-block corridors. Pieces, not just one piece. I guess I could just conclude on those by saying that they are really key to our concept, to achieving the concept and vision of South Campus. They're part and parcel both of the pedestrian connectivity, and they establish big pieces of the public realm that are going to be part of the long-term vision for South Campus.
You mentioned earlier in your testimony that with the height increases proposed by the university, towers would be located on campus more so than it currently exists. Can you describe a couple of the development standards that will ensure adequate light and air between those towers?
Yes, in doing that, I also might be assisted by page 250, a diagram that talks about building form and identifies a minimum tower separation of 75 feet. That goes a long way towards ensuring light and air in the neighborhoods in which towers are developed. You also see there the 25-foot wide mid-block corridor where those fall would make a clear separation between buildings. A podium height at a maximum of 45 feet from the ground, and a second level setback, which I mentioned earlier, at 90 feet, and I neglected to say, or at 120 feet, depending on the street. Actually, along Pacific, the second setback is at 120 feet, whereas on streets like Campus Parkway and the Ave, it's the second setback would be at 90 feet. I think that.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about view corridors. Would they also contribute to separation between tower structures? And can you tell me a little bit how those are envisioned to work under the plan?
Sure. If you just turn to the next page, 252 and 253, it's a two-page spread on view corridors. I want to repeat, I think I mentioned before, that the university has not done this previously, although we have kind of informally tried to practice it. Here in this campus master plan, for the first time, we've tried to document it and define it in these terms by identifying specific view corridors, by diagramming the view that we're trying to ensure is preserved should and when or when development occurs adjacent to those view corridors. And I think as we've seen in some of the diagrams, of the sector diagrams that show development standards and design guidance, we've identified actual viewpoints from which which relate to these images, these 12 images that you see on these pages. Buildings will be required to be kept out of the view corridors. That is what basically defines a view corridor for this campus and master plan. And we provide both visual interpretations through the photography with diagramming on top of that, as well as verbal descriptions to try to be as prescriptive as we can about and create an opportunity for design teams and project managers to understand what the intent is of these view corridors.
Great. You spoke a little bit about public realm allowances earlier. Did you want to expand on that discussion at all?
I'd love to.
Great.
If you turn to pages 242 and 243, I think this probably helps illustrate what I was trying to explain or express before. You see here four public realm allowance definitions on, you think, important streets throughout the campus. Stevens Way on the upper left, Brooklyn on the lower left, Pacific on the upper right, and Montlake on the lower right. And I should say that other streets that aren't individually described visually this way, the public realm allowance is generally 16 feet minimum on those other streets. But as you can see here, the setback is from the curb of the street right-of-way, and it establishes how close to that curb a new building or renovated addition, I suppose, but new construction can occur, and it establishes uses for some of that public realm allowance, trees, pedestrians, and more trees on Montlake. And Montlake is a special condition in a whole variety of ways, including that some of this right-of-way is owned by the state. And I think if you look on Brooklyn, you'll see that the public realm allowance on the right side, which is the east side of Brooklyn, is 6 feet wider than it's described as on the left or west side, and that's because of the incorporation of a 6-foot bike lane, consistent with the city's Green Street concept plan for Brooklyn. Okay.
So I think the last area of the development standards that we wanted to highlight was, is there a specific lighting and glare standard in the plan?
I know we want to minimize lighting impacts on Portage Bay. And our economics incentivize us to minimize night lighting inside buildings, and we comply with city requirements for shielding lights.
Okay. If you turn to page 239, it's a little bit confusing because it's under light and glare.
And we're saying lighting should be done in a manner to conserve energy and mitigate significant adverse impacts of light and glare on campus buildings and spaces and adjacent residential areas, consistent with needs for safety and security, that it would be shielded and directed away from structures in adjacent or budding residential zoned areas and lighting arterials, we will restrict uplighting. The maximum height limit for light poles is 100 feet. although that height may be exceeded through city-university agreement amendment process. And engineers' report may be required to study light impacts if additional height is proposed and we permit solar panels.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So last, we just wanted to highlight the university's internal design and development review process. As the university's architect, I'm sure you're very familiar with that process.
Immersed,
that's a great word. Wondering if you could provide an overview of that for us.
Sure. We have a significant internal process that involves many stakeholders, and I'll describe it in as basically four steps for designing and producing a building. The scoping of a project, it begins with the scoping of a project in which goals for that particular project are carefully thought through and established, and then they're used as measurements or standards for ensuring that we're achieving what we set out to achieve and helping to diminish scope creep over time. Getting clear of the program concept is kind of it evolves, but getting clear at the beginning is really important to everything from site selection on. We work on a business plan. Our funding sources are multiple these days. It used to be that the university's capital facilities were largely developed with state funding. Now that's a small part of our funding strategy. Includes philanthropy and debt as well. We have to have a funding plan before we move forward. Site selection is a very involved process. We take all of our site plans to CUCAC and are building plans early to CUCAC. We engage in the selection of the design team and the regents approve. That is all to say sort of elements of the scoping process to define a project before we're actually moving on that project. It's actually more complicated than that, but that kind of sums it up. The entities, individuals, and groups who are involved in those steps include many different departments at the University of Washington, Marin Capital Planning and Development, Facilities Services, Environmental and Health Services, Advancement, and others. They include the end users, deans, chairs of departments, development officers, key faculty and administrators, and students who will be sort of proxies for the people who are using the building when it's done. Campus stakeholders, including the associated students of UW and the graduate and professional students, the Faculty Senate and various committees of the Faculty Senate, neighbors and others through the environmental process, CUCAC, and others. And we have key advisors as well that we convene to give us a kind of peer review on architecture and landscape architecture. The University of Washington Architectural Commission convenes several times over the course of a design project to help us make sure that we aren't missing something important and that we get the best possible products. We do the same thing with the University Landscape Advisory Committee. This is on major projects, and we have a similar function, but it's an internal staff function that we focus on minor projects because we do thousands of minor projects every year and a handful of major projects every year, and if you add up impacts of 1,000 minor projects, they probably are greater than the impacts of a few major projects, so you want to get them right too. We also have an internal review committee on the ADA to be sure that we are moving in the direction of universal access in our facilities and our sites on campus. We have my role, a university architect, and a similar role, a university landscape architect, participating throughout the design and development process, trying to do the kinds of things that I was talking about, why we're having a long-term vision here, thinking about how the individual project is relating to and contributing to the overall campus setting. We favor integrated design and design excellence, as well as good use of funds and highly functional and flexible buildings. We work with interdisciplinary design teams to achieve all those things, and we have we include in that historic and cultural resource information and stewardship. And every project also has its own governance in a project executive committee that consists of members of many departments, the end users, students. So that's what's operating during the design process. And design is an iterative process, and we kind of circle it around as it progresses from very conceptual to very detailed and construction documents. The project executive committees continue to bring university and end user interests together and resolve any differences during the construction process. And we recently developed a transition to occupancy program that engages facility services who then have to take on the buildings to maintain and operate them. So that's sort of the lifespan.
Sounds like there's a lot of folks involved. You alluded to this, I think, but is there kind of two different review committees for major projects versus minor projects? And what is your definition of a major project versus a minor project?
Well, it's
and if you
it's turn, a dollar difference.
If you turn to pages 152 and 153 in the plan, there's more information.
Well, I'll be sure to be consistent with what it says on 152 and 153, but I would say it's both a dollar difference and a qualitative impact difference. So I think you're referring in particular to major and minor projects with the potential for impacts on the visitor experience of campus settings are reviewed by the University of Washington Architectural Commission, the University Landscape Advisory Committee, and or the University of Washington Design Review Board. And the intent is to foster good stewardship of the campus setting.
That's great.
Okay.
And then just one more area where I'd like you to dive in a little bit more deeply. We heard from KUCAC that they're concerned about site W37. So if you could turn to page 194 and describe a little bit more the design guidelines and development standards that would apply to that site.
Could you say that?
194.
194. Yeah, so that on page 194, we have a development zone K, which W37 sits within. At the right or east end of that development zone is University Bridge, just to orient people. And the Brook-Gilman Trail runs along the north edge of it, the upper edge of it. The shape that is shown there, you can see in that well, maybe I should also call attention to where it is in the plan on page 195. And that is, it's the one site that's got color on it that's left of the University Bridge. And you can see that we've stationed a view court, a viewpoint, at number 8, which is off the north end of that site. And the shape that is shown here is a shape that has a low podium, as you can see in three dimensions, that does come into the view quarter, but it's at a low height compared to the bridge. And the fact is that from the, I would say, bottom of W37 to the top of W37, there is a topographic increase of, I think it's something like 30 feet.
Caitlin, do you?
I'm sorry, I think, yeah. It's a substantial increase in height, and that allows for some development to happen kind of below the view corridor. And then the height of the building that's shown there, which is able to implement the gross square footage allowed on that site, is outside of that view corridor. So that is the intent here and the means by which we think we can develop on W37 and respect the view corridor.
Okay, great. Are you familiar with the topographic context kind of headed into the university district north of this site?
It continues to rise topographically. So that while the development, allowable development heights to the north in the university district are lower than what we're asking for the height on W37, because W37
is down and the rest of the university district is up, the greater height on W37 is relatively similar to the height that's allowed on the upper level.
Does that explain what?
That does. Just give us one.
Sure.
Are you familiar with SCCI's request to move this view corridor slightly and replace it with a different image in the plan?
The university is aware of that.
Okay.
You're referring to condition 26.
Yeah.
For the record, that's condition 26, and in the appendix that we've submitted, we agree to that condition. Condition 26.
To modify that slightly.
And what does the condition change to then?
It modifies the position of that viewpoint slightly.
Which way?
Carol?
To the south.
Looking more to the west.
To the bridge.
This is the condition.
Yeah.
And we're handing more compared to the space.
This is in the report on pages 58 and 59.
All right, thank you.
It does not show a before and after.
No, you have to look at page 253 of the master plan, figure view corridor number 8.
While standing on the university bridge.
Yes.
Right.
Okay, right. Thank you.
No further questions.
All right.
In the rain, in the cold rain.
No,
all right.
I think that concludes my remarks.
Any questions?
No further questions.
I believe Ms. Altman would like to pose a question.
I wanted to clarify, if I could. You mentioned on the first part of your testimony that there were four streets that the university was interested in protecting, and I think that's through the public realm.
Could you pull up your microphone, please?
Sure. The public realm allowance.
Public realm allowance. Mm-hmm. And the four streets, are those the ones that are listed?
Yes, and what I meant was the four that are specifically identified that I named, that we had the diagrams for. They were, I can't remember, let's see, what page was that on? 242 and 243.
So I think I just wanted to clarify.
But other streets have a public realm allowance also, where it's not called out separately or individually. It's a 16-foot minimum from the curb to the face of the building.
Okay, so that's on all of the public streets?
Correct.
The description is. And just to clarify, Stevens Way is not a public street, right?
That is also correct. Okay. That is a campus street, okay. Yeah. But we need to have it.
Oh, we got to take care of your
there office. As well.
Just to clarify quickly, when we say public street, it's a university-owned street versus a city-owned street.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is that what you mean?
That is what I mean.
Okay.
all accessible.
Then they wouldn't all be, wouldn't they all be public since?
Right. They are all
public. Okay.
It's public university.
Anything further from the department?
No, that's all. That was just clarifying.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
On Monday, what are your topics that you're going to be covering?
So on Monday, we anticipate starting with Professor Wei, who's going to talk, elaborate a little bit more on the Innovation District, what that's supposed to look like, what's intended there, and on academic partnerships that would go on there. I think after that, we'll have our two transportation consultants testify. One will focus on transit issues. The other will cover kind of the rest of transportation. Depending on how things are going, I anticipate we would start Ms. Doherty's testimony on Monday as well. And she's covering a broad range of topics, open space commitments, changes that the plan went through from the draft to the final in response to comments from the public. And then she'll start talking about some of our areas of disagreement with the city, and mm-hmm. I'm hoping that we'll have
more areas.
That'll be less by the time we get to it. And, you know, given how many we got through today, I'll say Ms. Clark would follow her and is going to elaborate more on the university's efforts around affordable housing and child care and those sorts of things. And then Professor Lazowska, we have, he's coming back from Africa on Sunday, so I didn't want to make him come in on Monday. But if we need to, we can have him come and talk on Monday. Otherwise, he'd be Tuesday morning.
Okay, we can talk.
He's going to talk about the need for enrollment capacity increases, particularly in STEM fields. And he'll also talk a little bit about the Innovation District and what we envision there. And that's it for us.
Okay.
So thank you for the accommodation you provided me about an hour ago. I realize now, looking back at my notes, what I requested was that we start on Tuesday at 1 o'clock, when normally we would start at 1:30. I'm still wondering if it might be possible on Tuesday to start at 1 so we can get Mr. Glass Hastings in that window that he has, and then we can go to public testimony at 1:30.
Okay. We'll need to adjust the lunch hour, but that's fine as long as we still have public testimony at the published time.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
I'm fine with that.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Remind me.
Posted note.
Okay. Anything further we should cover tonight? All right. Thank you all. We'll recess for the day.